letting me speak here, and thank you, Matt, for organizing the visit. So I'm going to talk about a connection between current conduction in wires with impurities and particle production in cosmology. And most of the stuff I'll be talking about is in this recent paper with Daniel Bauman, and some of the work I'll be presenting towards the, in the later part of the talk is ongoing work with Daniel Green and Hongyi Zi. Daniel Green is at Berkeley, and Hongyi Zi that is a condensed matter postdoc at Rice. Right, so let's start with something we all agree on. This is, as we saw this morning in Jens's talk, you know, we have this beautiful map of the cosmic microwave background. And the one thing it has taught us is that the observed early universe is exceptionally simple. The fluctuations are mostly Gaussian. It's almost scale invariant. They're adiabatic and seemingly acausal. This part is, of course, not the simple part. This acausal part, of course, has a potentially simple explanation, which is inflation. So an exponential expansion in the early universe combined with zero-point fluctuations at that time can give rise to the necessary acausal correlations at almost Gaussian scale-invariant, roughly scale-invariant adiabatic spectrum of fluctuations. So at least inflation potentially provides a simple explanation. Of course, the question mark is there because do we really understand the physics of inflation? What is it that drives inflation? How did the universe get populated with particles at the end of inflation? And perhaps what I mean by do we understand the physics of inflation really means either how does it connect to some more fundamental theory, or how does it connect to the rest of known physics, the standard model physics that we know? And this connection is still missing. And this connection to standard model physics, I mean, it's a tall order to ask that we be able to connect it. Now, we are making our nice steps here up to a TEV with particle accelerators, and we are saying that we want to understand something at 10 to the 16 GeV. It's certainly a tall order. From the fundamental theory side, if you ask people to build models of this from a singular perspective or otherwise, you usually end up with not just a single field, but many fields. The structure is quite complicated. And the connection to standard model still remains tenuous. So this is a situation we find ourselves in. The observations are quite simple. Theory, not so much. Okay. So what should a theorist like me do in this situation? Okay. And I want to advocate taking a somewhat coarse-grained view of the theory in the sense that I don't want to know the details of the Lagrangian of what caused inflation and reheating. I want to take a more coarse-grained view of it, get some information for there, and then develop calculational tools that can take this coarse-grained information to make predictions that are sufficient enough to explain relatively simple data. So that's the plan. The motivation for sort of doing this comes from a surprising source. It comes from wires, and this is what the talk is going to be about. I benefited immensely from the literature on the condensed matter side, starting with Anderson in 1957, a book by Melo Pereira and Kumar, and Binaker's wonderful review. This is all about current conduction in wires with impurities, or the phenomenon of Anderson localization. In particular, I certainly learned a lot from this Lesueche review article by Müller and Delande. On the particle, on the cosmology side, I worked in particle production in the early universe. So I was aware of the literature there, of course. But in particular, I learned a lot from this paper by Brandenberger, Bassett, and company, and so on. Okay, so let me get into a little bit more detail here. So imagine a situation where we have inflation. You know, we don't know what causes inflation. It's just a cartoon. Okay? So let's imagine for the moment that it's some scalar field that's driving it. And there are many other fields present as well. I'm not saying this is a fundamental scalar. It's some mode that could be driving inflation, a collective mode even. Okay? But there are many other fields that are coupled to it, and similarly also during inflation. And there's random particle production events going on here, here, here. How are we to describe this process? In a simplistic version, if you expand around a homogeneous background and you look at the mode functions for the Fourier modes of any of these fields, it will look like the equation of a harmonic oscillator. Okay? And the equation of the harmonic oscillator with a potentially time-dependent mass And the time-dependent mass includes aspects of expansion as well as couplings that this field might have. And this effective mass, you know, even though it's written as squared, could be positive, negative, going up and down in whatever way. So this is, if there are lots of fields interacting and so on, this is the equation describing the evolution of modes that describe the various light species present at that time. How were we to solve this system? The same problem has been encountered before in the context of, you know, standard quantum mechanics. In particular, let's take the simplified version of the time-independent Schrodinger equation written here. This is just in 1 plus 1, just in one dimensions. Notice that this equation, of course, is identical to the equation describing the evolution of mode functions here. Random variations in the effective mass here would correspond to random variations in the potential. So here is sort of that plot, you know, for technical reasons, I'm plotting time going this way and x going the other. And this problem is what was solved by Anderson. What he showed was that without knowing all the details of the impurities present, without knowing what kind of fluctuations you have and so on, if you take a large enough sample of this sort of a wire, okay, with impurities in it, you will find that the wave function has a universal behavior. And the universal behavior that he found is that you will get localization of the wave function. Instead of a diffusing wave function or a wave function that's spread everywhere, you actually get a localized wave function. And this, it's impressive simply mainly because it doesn't depend upon the details of the impurities. Purely one-dimensional cold wires become insulators. Cold, this is not, you would say, well, you know, we have Ohm's law, clearly this is not the case. But these are cold wires, okay, thermal fluctuations are small, so it's an idealized case. But in such a case, you would get this behavior. Given that this equation is identical, you should also expect similar universal behavior for the solutions. And in this case, you find that these mode functions on average, grow exponentially. Again, relatively independent of the details of what's going on. So this, let me just review a little bit why this connection works. This part is, of course, not new. I think this is present in textbooks that you can treat particle production as scattering. So imagine you have some state initially. If you can replace tau by x, this is a wave, a wave in a potential, or if you're thinking of in terms of time, this is the initial state. You have some, yes?
Sorry, David.
Yeah.
Before you go on, can you go back to the other slide? I just had a quick question.
Yes.
So in the cosmology picture,
yes.
the m squared blows up as tau goes to zero. Does that matter here?
So m squared blows up, what do you mean?
I mean the m squared goes like 1 over tau squared. Like,
sure,
in
yeah.
That tau goes to zero. So are we just looking at like before that blow up, or does that matter?
So I'm right now, it's more relevant here, as I'm thinking of a period later on, okay, where it's, the time, at least in this talk, the time scale is short compared to the Hubble. So then, why does that, so that shouldn't matter. Or if you, oh, sorry, you're thinking of early times.
No, I'm saying, so conformal time is negative.
Right.
And as you go to zero from below, then m squared blows up.
Yeah.
So these random fluctuations would maybe just be varied by that blow up.
Sure. So you would have, yes. If you were, so early enough case, right, you would just be in the Bunch-Davis state, as always. And then as you evolve through, say, you pass through the horizon and so on, these random fluctuations would dominate over the regular.
I'm talking about
the end of inflation. Oh, sorry, okay. So at end of inflation, I mean, just change time to regular time and you see that there is no problem, right?
Yeah.
So this is a coordinate thing then,
it's
rather
a power law, I guess. It's just how big does the bump have to be at a given conformal time to get above the low something. Maybe we can just...
Okay, but I would say that, so it's clear. Yeah. Sorry?
You're talking about the behavior of energy makes the horizon very
quiet. Yeah, I'm just saying that in a distinct universe, the m squared is just 1 over tau squared, or maybe minus 1 over tau squared.
Where you're following your gears goes up and then comes down, you're actually following it in fact all the way through the horizon.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
We can. I mean, I'm not sure why.
In other words, isn't the sharp bump here is, roughly speaking, that one on the cusp where you're turning up and turns over and comes down.
But then you don't really want to.
So are you, would you, if there was no expansion, would you, this is not an issue, right? Now, if you imagine that you are in a, let's say instead of de Sitter, just say you are in effort, some other regular power law expansion, right? You would have some weak expansion effect, and instead of writing in conformal time, I could write in regular time. You just have a friction term, an H term there. And this effective mass term would just be an extra term on top of that.
In that case, m squared is negative, right? You have so in your
Yeah, I think if you, so the reason this seems weird a little bit is because, so you can certainly imagine that the tachyonic part is roughly of order h squared. So if m effective squared, the stochastic piece is large compared to that, it doesn't matter if there's a tachyonic part or not there. Right? Okay, we can. Maybe we'll come to it.
I think the bigger problem is that it's not seeing the value theorem.
Yes, I clearly. So getting back to it. So in terms of this, so Matt, if that's bothering you for the moment, just imagine we are in flat space and just some rapidly changing mass, but we can talk about it in a moment. So this behavior of the exponential particle production happens, and it's relatively independent of the details of what kinds of fluctuations there are, or long enough time scales. So this particle production, of course, you can think of it in an initial state. You have a non-adiabatic change in the mass, and you produce particles. If you want to take a particle in a box in its ground state, move the walls rapidly, you see that you will end up in an excited state than what you were before. Yes?
Confusing everyone by bringing up the period where the horizon negligence.
Yeah, I don't.
We're talking about repeating and all these bumps in M and here because there are all these other technical fields.
That could, right. So if you're thinking in terms of reheating, I can talk about it in terms of inflation. In reheating, it's a little bit easier because you don't have mode exit. But there are all these fields around. You could have expansion in the background, sure. But you have these rapid changes in the fields, right? And that's what's happening.
So you're talking about sub-horizon and so that term is.
It can be ignored, right, exactly. But you can, as I'll describe a little bit later, you can talk about inflation as well. You have to be a little bit careful because of this 2 of tau squared term. But as long as you're sub-horizon, none of these effects will be wrong. Okay, so now what happens in the scattering process, you can write the state after and connect it to the before with a transfer matrix like this. Of course, just like in a scattering problem, you can define transmission and reflection probabilities as before. You can show that the occupation number in the time picture is related to these transmission and reflection probabilities. The transmission occupation number is just the inverse of the transmission probability. And you can show this quite easily. So keep this in mind as we go forward. Now you can, if you want to connect what happens not just in one scatterer, but many of them, you just have a transfer matrix for each one of them. You multiply them together and you can get to the final state from the initial. So this is a formal way of how you would get the final state once you start with something if you knew the scatterers. But we don't want to do this problem step by step in this way. That's the whole point, right? We don't want to know all the details of the scattering matrix. So here I'm going to show you a different way of doing this, which is the following. Okay, so first let me just show you a movie of what's happening. On the vertical axis is a logarithm of the occupation number. On the horizontal axis is time. There will be a black curve here that will be the M effective, that is the change in the effective mass. And then the orange will be the occupation number as it changes. So as you'll see, when the mass starts changing, you will have you will have particle production events going on. If it changes in a negative, you're much more likely to have a big change. Even if it's positive, you can have a change. It's not necessarily just correlated to it being negative or positive. Okay? It's just a rapid change that matters more. So this is the way the occupation number is changing as your effective mass changes.
Mostly changes at negative, not
positive. So it's a feature of this simulation. It's not actually true. Okay? depending on the parameters that you choose, you can have the positive ones. It's omega dot over omega squared that matters. Not so much. But if you are in the tachyonic regime, that tends to dominate. But you don't need the tachyonic.
It doesn't matter what direction.
Yeah. It's omega dot over, m dot over m squared that really captures this. So now imagine doing this with.
Although if you allow for back reflection, so actually getting additional interactions, you would be expecting more chaotic data, I guess. So you're really just making. I mean, there's no such thing as the particles are now in an ensemble and they're producing.
No, there is both enhancement. I mean, yeah. Okay, so now imagine that, you know, we of course don't know exact behavior of this effective mass changing. So imagine an ensemble of this, you know, like we do in statistical mechanics, we're going to average over such an ensemble. So these are all different trajectories for different realizations of the effective mass. And it turns out that even though it's hard to, without knowing the details of the mass, it's hard to predict what each individual trajectory is going to do, you can have a rather nice description of the behavior of this ensemble. What we were able to do is derive a Fokker-Planck-like equation for the evolution of this ensemble of trajectories. And it essentially has, in this simple picture, it has one parameter that is some average local particle production. So this was sort of nice to have this description here and capturing a lot of the complexity in this one parameter. You can derive, I'm not going to go through this detail here, but you can derive the Fokker-Planck equation from first principles and so on. If you're interested in how we got there, I can talk about it. You know, you just start, you know, what is the probability of going a step further given what you know here and the transition probability, the usual way we do this. As I said, once the derivation is done, there is one parameter here, the local mean particle production rate, that is effectively sort of asking about an ensemble average of what's happening locally, and then you can predict the global behavior in terms of long times. This equation can actually, you can solve it formally. You actually have a complete analytic solution for this, but it's not very enlightening. So we're just gonna look at the moments of this distribution. You know, so what is the average occupation number? What is the variance over the mean squared, et cetera? And here's what you find. Okay? The average grows as an exponential, but the variance over the mean squared also goes as an exponential, and it grows faster, actually. So this is not a good thing to use. The mean is not a good description of this ensemble. If you take a mean of the logarithm of the occupation number, this turns out to be a much better description. It goes linearly, and the variance over the mean squared actually now decays. So you find a very good, this is what will be a good description of the ensemble. Indeed, you can make a prediction that the typical occupation number, which is the most probable value, will grow as e to the mu k tau. Yes? Sorry?
What does mean?
What is?
Mu k.
So mu k is, it's the local particle production rate. So we're trying to make a behavior of the long-term behavior by knowing something statistically about individual scatterers. That's what we're doing.
So you're probably going to go into this, but first of all, particle production, that means there must be the analog kind of particle destruction, I guess, the inverse process. And shouldn't the occupation numbers go towards whatever statistics the particles have, like Bose statistics or statistics, isn't that something?
But there's no, I mean, the particles, these particles are not interacting with each other, right? So it's just production in a background. That's what's really.
Right, so you're basically assuming that it's not.
That is just, there's nothing that is thermalizing them.
Right.
Okay. At the moment, at least, yeah.
Sorry, just one last question.
Yes.
Big tau is closer to the end of inflation or closer to the beginning of inflation in this convention?
In this, big tau would be, oh gosh. So it's time. So tau is time, just think of the T, and it goes bigger at late times.
Okay.
So it's increasing at late times.
So this isn't really the conformal time?
If it's conformal time, it's still increasing at late times. That's the convention here. So tau is getting bigger and bigger as you go late. It could be conformal time, but because of the negative value, I'm just, I don't want to say it. Sorry, okay.
Got it. And
the occupation number, because when I think about the occupation number, it is a energy-specific
yes.
So this is not.
It's k-dependent, right?
It's mu k.
Mu k is the momentum of the Fourier mode that you're talking about. So it is always, I mean, I'm just not writing the k here because it.
I see.
But that's why this mu k is always there with the k. Okay, so you can make this sort of a, you can solve the Fokker-Planck equation, make a prediction of what the typical number would be. Sorry, no, no, go ahead. Yes, ask.
I'm really sorry.
Yes.
The maximum occupation number is 1, or no, at the end of the equation.
So,
I think it just keeps growing.
This is, it just keeps growing, that's it. Right? It's 0 initially, and it keeps growing. When tau is 0, it's 0, and it keeps on growing.
So maybe you want to put like tau minus tau initial?
Sure, I can put tau minus tau initial, yes. Yes.
I have a question.
Yes.
Which is totally confusing me. So, say you have this interaction,
yes.
And particle production, the whatever, you're basically saying that you're now, afterwards you have two particles, let's say,
yeah.
at this k, which is for you the kind of energy, but you have taken the energy from somewhere. So it's
yes.
not like you're splitting up the energy of the incoming particle
no.
or whatever.
No, I'm taking energy from the background.
From the background.
Yes.
So you're not having actually something like a real scattering event in the sense of
no.
like going to other k's.
No, this is single k mode.
All right.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, okay. In some sense, it is a scattering event that
from zero. Yes, it's going
from. Whatever is creating your M of
yes. So it is scattering in the sense of it's going from the zero mode of what the background into this high k mode that is being produced. Right? But if you're willing of not including the background, then you're just producing particles. So the background, if I did it at each wave number will have a different occupation number.
How long, I mean, the background is sort of the adiabatic evolution.
Yes.
So, I mean, if you grow exponentially in the wave, like do you at some point deplete and change the background order 1?
Yes, so we will talk about this too. So right now, let me just set up the formalism and we'll talk about all the... There are many things that need to be done, as you will see. But let me first... So if the expansion and all of that is concerning right now, let's imagine we are in flat space and something is producing particles, and we want to describe what happens to many stochastic particle production events okay, in that scenario. Okay, so one nice thing is that, okay, I mean, by I, of course, this looks like a... reasonable good description of this, and you can calculate the variance and so on as well. But the Fokker-Planck equation, if you compare it to at least numerics, it works very well. Okay? Here is again sort of the curves are actually what you get from the solution of the equation. It approaches a log normal distribution as you go forward in time. Okay? Again, like all things like this, you can think in terms of the central limit theorem, and you'll see it's a log of n that really is normally distributed, and not n itself, and you get a very good description of this behavior. Of this ensemble of trajectories that I mentioned as time goes on. And again, trajectories is number of occupation number per time. Okay. So you can actually, I mean, I've just told you sort of one example of this. We can develop a dictionary that translates this, what's going on here and what's going on here. The resistance is related to the occupation number. Again, you can imagine transmission probabilities are related to how much conductance and so on you have in the system. Those are related to occupation number. Local particle production rate is related to mean free path. And as I will describe next, in multiple fields end up relating to multiple channels, that is current conduction and thick wires. So let me talk a little bit about this coupled multi-field dynamics. So you have this, if you want to describe coupled fields, again, coupled in the sense that the background is such that different fields are talking to each other through the background, then you have, instead of just being an effective mass, you have some matrix connecting them. And this finds a really nice analog in terms of wires as well. Again, you require thick wires. There's quantization in the transverse direction that couples modes in the longitudinal one. And the equations, again, describing that turn out to be identical to what I've written here. And this is, I think, where the real power of this sort of analogy helps you, because at least I don't know of any framework that people have looked into where you can deal with such multiple fields together. So again, the way you do it is no different, but now this transfer matrix, instead of being a 2x2 matrix with transmission and reflection probabilities, actually has transmission and reflection matrices inside. So it's a higher dimensional matrix, but the procedure remains the same. You just map the initial state to the final state going through this process. And the occupation number now becomes a trace over a matrix, which is, of course, just a sum of the eigenvalues, and that is directly related to these total transfer matrix that you get by multiplying them together. The expression is a little bit more complicated, but hopefully you get the idea. So amazingly, this multi-field evolution can also be described by a Fokker-Planck-like equation. And this has been derived in the condensed matter side. It goes under the name of DMPK equation. So it describes how the probability distribution of the eigenvalues of this matrix, of this occupation number matrix, evolves as a function of time. It looks rather complicated, and you would think that this would be impossible to solve, but again, even though you can still write down a formal solution for P, yes?
What is capital NF?
So that's the number of fields that you are, so here.
Is it like number of transverse modes, is that the?
Yeah, you could think of this as a number of transverse modes. Right?
But that's not finite, or I guess there's an infinite hierarchy of it. So you truncate it somehow.
You truncate it somehow.
And what are NAs? They are
each mode. Okay, so of course, I mean, this is a time-dependent system, so you can't say in the same basis for all time. But it's the eigenvalues of the matrix, of the occupation number. So there'll be N occupation numbers for the N fields. So these are the eigenvalues of that matrix. Okay? So that's how you should think of the eigenvalues. I think I can't tell them that they belong to this field or the other. Once again, as before, you can define this mu that appears, the parameter that appears here, is the local mean particle production rate. Again, I always have this picture in mind that I want to describe the long-term behavior in terms of some properties of these scatterers, some statistical properties of these scatterers. So this describes the statistical properties of these scatterers, and then I derive a long-term behavior of this system. So the total occupation number, this sum of all the eigenvalues, again, this amazed us when we did this, that you can actually derive these moments and so on analytically. It has a very similar behavior to what we had before, but you will see the appear of NF at more places now. And you do this derivation, you carry it out. Again, the same behavior, it's a log that's better, it's a better description. By the way, sorry, there should be a 2NF over NF plus 1 over here. The mean grows exponentially, but the variance grows faster, so not a good way to characterize it. But the logarithm of the occupation number and taking the mean afterwards is a good quantity. Again, you can define the most probable occupation number. And we did this, you know, you go through the whole calculation. Again, details are in the paper. And we've tested this now. So we take this prediction and we ask, okay, how does this mean occupation number change with the number of scatterings? The orange line is a theoretical prediction. The dotted lines are from actual simulations that we have done. They match pretty well over the number of fields. Okay? Any number of fields you want, you can do quite well. Indeed, as the number of fields becomes larger and larger, this becomes simpler and simpler. Okay? Again, back of your mind, think central limit theorem. Something like that is at work. So the mu dependence there is always, so it's proportional to there is a mu here. There's always a mu that I can't get rid of. Okay, that describes the properties of the scatterers. So it's just multiplied by mu here.
The mu's are not kind of field dependent, meaning they don't distinguish the particles.
They don't distinguish the particles because and again, it's a great question, and I'll get to this in a moment. Okay, but they are functions of k. So these occupation numbers are functions of k. In general, this is a pretty important point. And for people who have done reheating-like studies, usually what you find that occupation numbers are highly dependent on the wave number that you're talking about. Some wave numbers grow, some don't. That is a feature because you do particle production quite periodically. Okay? Those bands that you get, similar to block waves that you get in condensed matter systems, those are a feature of periodic potentials. Once you remove the periodicity, you actually get particle production at all wave numbers. Okay? It's not, you don't have to pick and choose a wave number, and this is nice. Okay? And how does it depend? Usually there is more particle production at lower wave numbers. Okay? The lower the wave number, the more easier it is. Got less energy, the easier it is to produce. Okay? But there's now a continuum, as opposed to some band structure that you have. So this qualitative picture will remain for all wave numbers, all energies that you will be talking about. Again, we've also checked it with the number of fields, and it works quite well. So something that, again, this is pretty much, I mean, this is a slide, you should take it with a grain of salt. It turns out that in condensed matter systems, you can find combinations of observables that become independent of this mean particle production rate. So Ghazal, you asked this question about this mu. You would have to get it from theory, but certain sets of observables, like the mean conductance fluctuations, turn out to be independent of even those properties of the scatterers. They only depend upon the geometry of the wire and so on. So there's a possibility that something similar will happen in the some combination of observables. I mean, again, this is not crazy. Right? I mean, if you have two or three observables, you can take ratios and get rid of, as long as it's something physical, that'd be nice. But there is a possibility there are certain combinations that will actually get rid of that dependence, and we are looking for things that would be observationally relevant. Okay. Yes?
Okay, so you're assuming they all have the same mu here?
There is one mu in this problem. There is one mu in this problem. It's a function of wave number.
In reality, I guess different fields would have different mu.
But we want to characterize it by an average, right? What is the average particle production total?
As I was saying, we were discussing this before, that there's an infinite hierarchy, for example, in the case of wire. So presumably then, you want to, there is some sort of a weighting with mu or what NF is.
Yes.
You basically could label different types of particles and in that sense, like create a proportionality of different particles.
Sure, I could. I think.
You had actually mu's, which would be really.
Would be very different, but I think here the assumption I'm making, and for this to, this at least the simple picture to work, I'll complicate it in a moment. The simple picture to work, you're assuming that all fields are statistically equivalent at the moment. Right? Otherwise, you don't have a single number characterizing them. Otherwise, you would say that, you know. But I will show you what happens when you deviate from this. So, Jens, you're absolutely right. Each one will have its own mu. I'm assuming they're all roughly statistically equivalent, so one number characterizes them all. Okay, so in that assumption, you have one number characterizing this particle production and the number of fields. Okay, this is similar to just having a mean-free path characterizing, no matter what the impurities, okay, a mean-free path characterizing what's happening in wires and the number of channels. So just as the question was asked, the two things that were asked, you know, this assumption that all the fields are statistically equivalent, and what Tomas asked about the adiabatic evolution of the variables, right? In a cosmological setting, there's expansion and so on. Whatever is doing it, you could imagine things evolving. And this still needs to be worked out. We haven't done this all in complete detail, okay? But given the at least during reheating, given the non-adiabatic particle production is likely to be much stronger than these effects, there will be some adiabatic evolution that can be put in at the end. For example, you produce particles. Okay? They will, because of expansion, you have to multiply them by a to the minus 3 to account for the expansion that you will dilute the occupation number as time goes on. But I suspect that's the way it will be taken care of. We are moving away from this assumption of statistical isotropy just to check how good the predictions end up being. And this is work done with Hong Yizi, who's a postdoc, and Osman Wen, both at Rice. And what we do find is this assumption of statistical isotropy of the fields. You can, of course, break it. No question, you can set that one field isn't produced and the other ones are produced. But it is relatively robust, and it's robust in a and the deviations are calculable. If you're interested in this, I can tell you more. This gets into quite a complicated story about the simple question that we are trying to answer is you have a collection of coupled harmonic oscillators. Okay? What happens to their energy as you change how they're stochastically coupled? And surprisingly, this is not completely discussed in the literature. I thought this would be a solved problem. But it's not completely well understood what happens when you change these stochastic couplings and don't assume they're all equivalent. So we're working on it, and I don't have a clean answer for this. But it is robust over a range of couplings. That is, they don't have to be all drawn from the same distribution. They could be drawn from different distributions, but they can't be terribly different from each other. That's what we've found so far. So far, how much time do I have? Okay, 20 minutes, okay. So far I've talked about characterizing the stochastic particle production using a Fokker-Planck-like equation. That requires a little bit of an assumption of, you know, enough number of scatterings happening and they're individually not being terribly strong. It's the equation is a partial differential equation with sense of continuity and so on. There, you can get away from this by using tools from random matrix theory. What is it that makes these kinds of things possible? Okay. There are two large numbers here. One, you could imagine the number of fields being large. That gives you the eigenvalue spectrum of these M matrices or transfer matrices, and there are some nice features of that they have. For example, eigenvalue repulsion and so on. So even though you have lots of eigenvalues, only one of them will dominate. So you only need to calculate the distribution of that, and that is known from the theory of random matrices. The other large number is that you have a large number of scatterings. So even though individually you might not know much, there are theorems that state what happens when you couple a large number of matrices together. Where is the randomness coming from? For example, the location of these scatterers along the line, or the amplitudes. Okay? And as long as you have large enough number of them, again, you can make some prediction about what the behavior is. For example, the exponential behavior of the eigenvalues can actually be calculated. Okay? So you don't have to go to the differential equation to do this. You can get these answers just from random matrices. Okay, so now coming to the part which is still very much work in progress. You know, the paper that so far the things I've talked about, you know, just it was done at the end of last year and we're still published recently. We're still working on the applications part. So this is just going to be a flavor of the things we are doing, but no actual results that I can tell you. So of course, what do we want to do with this if you're thinking about applying this in the context of inflation? Then we want to calculate the effect on curvature perturbations. So take the background, this complicated background dynamics, it produces particles, that will affect the curvature perturbations, and these curvature perturbations also establish correlations on long wavelengths. That will in turn also affect this particle production. So this kind of a process, and this is what currently with Daniel Bauman and Daniel Green, we are trying to look into it. The framework we are trying to work under is the one established by these two papers right here. It's effective field theory with dissipation. And here we have a source term. So the idea is that this particle production does, you know, it will be a source for the curvature perturbations, but could also affect the background dynamics. Is you're taking energy away from them, so it's going to slow the inflaton down to an extent. Both of these things have to be taken into account. So we're trying to work through that right now. So here, for example, this is an equation for the curvature fluctuation. It's affected by a source term, which has this particle production here. That source term then you can calculate in absence of curvature perturbations and in the presence of curvature perturbations and feed that back in to ultimately calculate what happened to curvature fluctuations. So it's, the framework is clear. We don't have the detailed results yet about what this will actually do or how big of an effect it will be.
What is T now? It's not
sorry, here? So here T, sorry. This is the clock during inflation. You can think of it as the field, the background field, right? So field shifted by pi, so it's just a clock. It could be T, you could call your field, homogeneous field during inflation, time if you wanted. Okay, so this is not our work. This is a recent work by Diaz, Frazier, and Marsh, where they, not using the framework that we have, in a different framework, they also looked at what the power spectrum looked like as you change the number of fields and so on with random potentials. And they found nice behavior. For example, this is with two fields. This is with, I think, if I remember correctly, 10-ish fields. And you see that the power spectra and so on become nicer and more predictable as you go to large number of fields. These are the kinds of things that we are expecting. And we are expecting not only to predict the average, but also the variance of this with the framework that we have. So this is sort of, again, done with a different framework. We are hoping to get something like this as well. Can just you sort of say, what would be different? I mean, reheating-like studies of particle production have been around for a long time. There are wonderful papers, starting with 1994, where the original paper was there, and then 1997 and onwards as well. But most of those involved particle production with some relatively periodic motion. And there were stochasticities because of expansion, but not that much more beyond that. Right? What we can do now is we don't have to worry about this periodicity or anything like that. There could be many fields, many interactions, and you can do the calculation. For example, if you wanted to know what was the efficiency, how quickly do you get particles, you can calculate how quickly this will grow, okay, in the framework that we have. So what are the potential future outputs that we expect? A variance of the power spectrum. This is a multi-field scenario, so of course there will be some evolution outside the horizon. We still need to characterize that properly in terms of the curvature fluctuations. Efficiency of reheating and how it depends on scale. This, I think, there's a potential that this might be quite generic. Again, because there won't be specific band structure corresponding to models that you have picked, but rather a general shape, because we're introducing randomness here. And again, as you can imagine, the first part of the talk didn't really include aspects of inflation or reheating in it. So anytime you have this random behavior that you can write down your equation as a harmonic oscillator with a rapidly, with non-adiabatic changing mass, you can apply it. So this is not specific to these applications, even though this is what we've been going after so far. So let me just summarize. So this is what we are trying to develop, is sort of a statistical tool where there's a lot of theoretical complexity, which we don't know all the details about. You've seen, hopefully, from here that despite this complexity, you can have some universal predictions, some behavior that's rather generic. Okay? If you were to go and calculate for each specific realization of this effective mass, it would take a long time to do this calculation every time. We're saying you don't have to do that. You can get at least statistical predictions about this without going through that calculation. Here's a more detailed version of the summary. So the two tools that I described, one was the Fokker-Planck equation. This is the one field one. You have the multi-field one as well. And I just mentioned random matrices, even though I haven't told you, we haven't done the work to actually make use of them yet. Told you that things like typical occupation numbers and so on are predictable, and they have a simple dependence on the mean particle production rate and the number of fields. And as you can imagine, as the number of fields gets large, the dependence on the number of fields is also dropping out, and only the mean particle production rate matters. You know, if it was up to Anderson, of course, you know, you'd ask the question whether the emergent simplicity that we see in the universe is really because there is a lot of underlying complexity, and somehow it's just conspiring to give you universal behavior. Right, so that's all I have. Thank you. Yes.
Matt, go ahead.
I'm like in charge, so you should talk about
it. Exactly. I have no idea. No, so is there a specific, you haven't talked about observables yet.
Yes.
So have you guys started looking, for example, because you haven't, I mean, I'm not an expert, so you didn't make the distinction between inflation and reheating.
Yes.
So far. So, for example, could you imagine that you have specific things that come in non-Gaussianities? So this is what
so,
you're eventually are envisioning that you
So we are certainly envisioning it. We are far from it at the moment to give you a prediction from non-Gaussianity. So in the sense, finding the variance of the power spectrum is, of course, related. You know, the four-point function. So we're trying to ask, okay, what is the variance around this? So we're certainly looking towards that, but we don't have a prediction yet.
Does it assume that it have, because at some point, right, that you have to assume, there seems to be a fight. Okay, you don't want the coupling to be super strong,
yes,
but you want it to be strong enough. And of course, there's constraints of how much things are going to couple.
Yes, yes.
So you have no idea about what, basically, is there a range for new that's allowed by the requirement that you already get inflation to begin with?
I don't. So this you're talking that the coupling will actually back, you know,
back,
the loop
yeah.
correction to yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So we haven't, I mean, we haven't put that in or thought about it, but
yeah.
I think a more prosaic concern is also you have exponential growth in something,
exactly,
okay?
Yeah.
It's going to stop at some point.
Yeah.
The calculation, it is the way to understand how, which one will win,
yeah.
is take the ratio of this mu to the Hubble scale at that time.
I see.
Okay? That's the characteristic number that will tell you which one wins.
Yes.
So mu over h, you calculate mu, you divide it by h, and you ask which one. If it's bigger, then the exponential expansion is going to win.
Yeah.
If it's smaller, it's going to have an effect,
yeah.
but not as much. Right? So that's the relevant ratio.
The other thing is, you thought about gravitational wave production.
Again, same. It can be applied,
yeah.
right? If you have some time. I don't know how to write. At least I haven't thought much about how to write down.
No,
when I write down the gravitational wave equation, it just has a.
Yeah,
it just has a scale factor in it, right? It doesn't have there. Yeah, it's stricter there. So I don't know how to write it down, but if you go to a slightly more
second order,
for example, yeah.
Make the particles, they back react on the expansion in which.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's certainly true.
So maybe you get stronger constraint from omega GW rather than from the actual detection of people.
Yeah, I don't know, because it's actually hard. I don't know. All I remember is because you mentioned Eva's mm-hmm. work. And
yes.
Eva had these crazy models, right? Where she had axial monotone and she was trying to produce more gravitational waves.
That's right.
And she was doing it through mechanisms like this.
That's absolutely
some
right.
Some parametric resonance.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Fields and they were becoming heavy and then decaying. And
absolutely.
Gravitational waves.
Absolutely. So this is certainly, I think, those kinds of things, I mean, can be done
yeah.
with here as well. Those do include back reaction effects, so it was not just a forward calculation all the way through. In fact, the work I mentioned by Nasir Porter and so on is basically taking that work and making it and developing a framework to calculate that.
Okay.
But that would be also something we can calculate here.
Yeah.
But we haven't done that in that specific
and
model yet.
The other thing is, for heating, how, if you get, because it's going to be the same field, same theory, right?
Yeah.
That will affect reheating. So if you have constraints in the coupling from having to have inflation in the yeah, I guess this is something I haven't looked at.
No, it's not that, it's correlated, but it's not that bad, right? Because reheating the fields, the couplings are not just coupling constants. It depends on what the evolution of
the phi is of
the inflaton or whatever there is, right? So it's not, so if you had that thing just stuck somewhere, it may not produce much particles.
Yeah,
but if the field starts evolving, it can do it. So it's those couplings, I think, are not, of course, you can't make the couplings to the inflaton too strong, just like in the usual way, because from quantum effects, you'll change the potential during inflation.
Yeah.
But I don't think you can say that just because it's not so much here, there's going to be nothing in heating.
What type of signal should we expect?
So here, right now, I'm not talking about, for reheating, I mean, it's a usual problem. The things I'm interested in for reheating aspect is what is the efficiency as a function of scale.
Okay.
Because I, of course, as you know, I also do simulations of reheating because this will become nonlinear if this grows rapidly. So I want to know how quickly do I have, how long before I have to start the nonlinear simulation, or do the fields actually get nonlinear and can I get away with it? What could it affect? It could affect things like the duration of reheating, the delta N that we now have uncertainty about.
Okay.
So that would be one thing that you would get a handle on by knowing how efficiently particle production is at this time. So that's one example of a direct observable. Indirect observable, because this is delta N, right? I mean, you can change.
Yeah.
A direct observable would be, if you were to go a little bit further, you could also, as we just discussed, you could also produce gravitational waves from this point, and high frequency gravitational waves, another example. Okay. One thing nice about this is that if you look at, if you could produce, and you will produce some gravitational waves, here the production becomes, of whatever fields you have, becomes more and more peaked at low momenta, which is good. Okay. Usually from reheating, what ends up happening is you can't go to too low momenta. Something cuts it off. This seems to be a preference for going towards low momenta. I haven't done the calculation. So it could help a little bit with the frequencies, kind of frequencies that you expect from gravitational wave from reheating. Yeah. Sorry? Closer to lower frequencies, right? So there is a possibility, but.
So what is the more like generic prediction
for the frequency of the
gigahertz?
Completely. If you are setting the energy scale of inflation to gut scale, gut scale inflation is gigahertz.
Well, what if you bring the but then it suppresses the production as well.
Not, it does. So that is incorrect, right? So so if you go to lower frequencies. For in reheating, it doesn't suppress the amplitude. The omega GW is not going to change.
So you can just have lower reheating temperature.
You can have lower reheating temperature. It's not, I mean, this is a complementarity. Of course, you don't gain, because as you go to lower
reheating
temperatures, you get, or lower scale of reheating, when this process is happening, you get to lower frequencies.
Yeah.
But the amplitude is mostly independent of this, because this is a classical process, or in the sense that this is stuff moving around. It is not relevant what the Hubble scale actually is for the amplitude. But this is, it's still tough. And in fact, I've talked to Ray Weiss some time back about what are the prospects of this, because at about 100 megahertz or so, I think the characteristic strain that you predict is still of order 10 to the minus 29-ish. Okay, so you shouldn't, but this is 100 megahertz. Now you go lower and lower, this gets better.
How does it get better?
So it's square root of, sorry? Yeah, it's not redshifting as much, so you can calculate. I think either it's, so omega GW is, I think it's square root of omega GW, it's because it's 1 over F.
1 over F.
I think it's, I forget which one it was. I think it's the characteristic or the chirp. H, one of the two, I forget which one. Sorry? Both two? Okay. So it goes as 1 over F. So you go to lower frequencies, you can do better. But it's still, it's far. So I wouldn't try to sell it as saying that
this is
easy.
Yeah.
But it's, I've always, look, I mean, this is a, but I mean, you, the things you do, trying to do gravitational wave detection,
I haven't come up with anything that's going to do so.
Yeah. but worth thinking in that direction, because these are the wavelengths are small.
Yeah. Okay,
that's, we don't need detectors, but you need extreme sensitivity.
Yeah, the best I know at those frequencies, above the megahertz, is some proposal this guy from Australia has that reaches 10 to the minus 22 hertz.
Okay.
Which is pretty good.
Yeah, pretty good. Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. But again, so I should say that number is certainly dependent on frequency, right? So.
Yeah, I think the story with these, the repeating predictions for gravitational waves, like Mustafa was saying, omega gravity wave is predicted to be independent of.
Yeah.
So as you lower the heat scale, the heat moves to lower frequencies, but omega gravity wave stays fixed. So the strain goes up and lower fast. So the best case scenario is when you move it. I think the best case scenario is when you push the preheat scale just low enough that heat is at about 0.1 hertz. Because then if you go below that, there's other astrophysical.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you want to be.
If you go right above that,
so by the way, I mean, just to give you a context, right, omega GW from inflation at those scales would be 10 to the minus 14.
Yeah.
Here you will get omega GW of order, and this is roughly independent of frequency, you will get of order 10 to the minus 11-ish. Okay. So this is higher than what you would expect from inflation at that scale. Okay. But it's still, I mean, nobody's going at these frequencies to measure the inflationary background. So it's certainly higher than the inflationary background, but still quite small.
Sorry,
the smallest
frequency you can get is what?
From
it's
a
parametric
theory
of
an
MeV or something, just push it as
low as you want, and then
it's
so it's
10
to the minus.
If I can push temperature as low as I can, which is roughly an MeV.
Yeah.
So what is the?
So I think it's 10 to the minus 3 hertz for a TeV, and it scales linearly.
Ah, okay.
Okay, so that's the way to. So for a TeV, it's 10 to the minus 3. 10 to the minus 3. Lisa was. No.
So, if
there's a good way of getting reheating at that scale, that would be fun. Can you think of it?
Yeah.
I know. I didn't mean to say that. This conversation is not going to end well, sorry. Exactly. No, so Mina, I had forgotten about your paper. So what is 10 to, what gets you reheating at an MeV?
Eh?
What gets you reheating at a MeV?
These models, if you have, sometimes it requires the best models I know, the nicest, doesn't mean they're good. The nicest models I know are models of supersymmetry. Well, it's basically when you have some modulus that decays late, and that modulus is also has some variable number violating properties, then you can reheat at whatever temperature you want. Because usually the biggest problem with low reheat temperature is getting the baryon number to work out, right? But using the baryon symmetry. So if you have some heavy modulus that decays late, then you can get it. And there's several models that have done it without baryon violation. There's even a paper by Lawrence, Paul, and Savas from 89.
I see.
That they did it. And they reheated with our baryon violating process with Suzy.
I see.
Look, just give us the
I think low reheating
the biggest problem with low reheating is by producing the baryon symmetry.
Okay.
Then you have to assume experimentally, this is as far as we know. So.
I see. Yeah, low reheating is good. Everything gets better in these predictions, right? Because you can move them closer.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, thanks.